A very good morning to everyone. Before we begin this morning, I would like to announce that the third member of our panel is Judge Alana Rovner. Judge Rovner is necessarily absent this morning because of a very important and pressing matter. She will listen to the oral arguments on the tape and will fully participate in the court's deliberations in these cases. So I want counsel to understand what the situation is in that respect. And now we can begin. We'll begin the call of the day. The first case is number 06-2797, James Hess against Reg Ellen employee.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Counsel, in this case, it's an ERISA claims denial. Plaintiff should have been deemed to have exhausted the plan administrative remedies by operation of law because of the plan's failure to comply with the ERISA claims procedures regulations and to provide the claimants with a full and fair review of their claim.
Mr. Hever, let's go.
Yes.
Is this an argument that you made before the district court?
Yes, I did, ma'am.
Because I thought that this deemed denial argument, your opponents at least thought, had not, in fact, been presented in this crisp a way.
Well, perhaps I've devoted more time in my appellate brief than I did in my briefs before the district court, but in my briefs before the district court and my reply brief and my motion for summary judgment, I devoted at least 4 or 5 pages to the exhaustion issue and the deemed denial, and I cited the ERISA claims regulation by citation, 29 CFR 2650503-1, 4 times in my arguments in the reply brief. Now, I did not believe that we didn't exhaust. I thought we exhausted. Based on the district court's opinion, I made it more clear in my brief to this court why we exhausted. I said the exhaustion, I said the exhaustion issue was moot. They didn't comply with the ERISA regulations. They didn't provide my clients with a full and fair hearing. I recognize, I didn't argue that exhaustion issue precisely as I have in my brief before you, but I did cite it 4 times, the regulations, and I did raise the proposition in a very major portion
of my brief.
In
your opening brief as well as the reply brief?
No, in my reply brief. And the reason for that is, Your Honor, is that the issue of exhaustion was never filed as an affirmative defense. It was never raised until after I filed my motion for summary judgment and my initial brief. Then in their response brief, they brought up this exhaustion issue. So the only time I had an opportunity to address it was in my reply brief. But the district court completely ignored it. They didn't even mention the ERISA claims procedures. They didn't even mention the regulations. They didn't even mention not getting a full and fair hearing.
I had a factual question for you, and actually, it's unclear to me, maybe this is very easy for you to answer, when all is said and done, your clients, of course, are long since past the age of 55 at this point, the march of time being what it is.
Yes, ma'am.
And I wondered, are they receiving at this time any benefits at all under the plan?
They had received distributions based on other plan provisions in 25% increments.
Okay. And did that start? They turned 55 in the year 2000, is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, in January 2000. I believe it started in 2001 when they first received their first 25% increment.
So have they received all 4 25% increments of what the plan thinks they're due? I realize there's a debate about amounts. But
they, as of now, they might have, but when I did my brief, there was still one pending for one of the claimants.
So at this point, is this case about what those distributions should have been if there had been a rollover back when you think there ought to have been a roll? What exactly are we doing now?
Yes, because there was a substantial reduction in what they got in those 25% distributions when they got them than what they would have gotten had there been the rollover.
Because the value of the stock is fallen, right?
Right, and it's my position is that should not have affected their vested benefit that vested when they terminated. The benefit vested when they terminated, so therefore the amount of their pension vested, and it was fixed. So they should have gotten that amount back in 1998.
Is it the under the plan, is it the amount that vests, or is it that you have X number of shares that
it
vests?
It says the amount, and they talk only in terms of dollars.
And which section is this?
$50,000 and other dollar segments. That's in Section 7.4A. It doesn't ever mention the stock, the number of shares of stock.
Yeah, it's talking about the vested portion
of their account balance, which is a dollar balance. Every year, the company issues them a certificate saying this is the amount, the dollar amount of your benefits. Mm-hmm. And, Judge, when they filed their Form 55R, 100R, with the IRS, which they're required to file, it's an annual registration form, they noted my two clients, James Hess and John Hess, as being separated participants with vested benefits in the dollar amount of what I allege in my complaint and brief, $205,000 and $465,000. Those are the amounts that the plan determined and reported to the IRS were the amounts of my client's vested benefits. It didn't say, oh, those are going to change every year because the stock value is going down.
So according to the plan, at what year? Was it in 2001 that was it the year in which they turned 55 that this dollar equivalent was computed?
No. It says that it's computed the year subsequent to their termination. And that's the year that it was computed in the IRS filing.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't say we compute that every year you get a distribution, which is what the plan has subsequently done. They not only said the first year you got it, we computed your benefit in the year 2000. Here's what it is. Now we're going to pay you out over. And I made a mistake. It's 20% increments, not 25% increments, over 5 years.
So and each of these 20% payments has been equal in value?
No, they've all been reduced.
Okay.
So they not only said in the year 2000, okay, for example, Mr. James Hess, you're entitled to $150,000, and we're going to divvy that out over 5 years in equal installments. No, in the year 2000, they gave him an installment based on what they said the value of his stock was then. Year 2001, it reduced again, and they gave him his reduced value again in 2002, 2003, and so on. So he not only didn't get it when they said he was entitled to get it, they kept reducing it every year.
Well, I mean, it strikes me this is an interpretation issue that has not really been explored, so I'm not sure how much we can get into it. But I guess I want to come back to another point that seems to separate you and your opponent, which is, I guess there are two parts to the question. One, who has the burden of identifying the section of the plan under which you think you're entitled to recover? Looks to me like what happened was the plan administrators put that burden on you and your clients, and you might be arguing it's on them, but I'm not sure about that. And secondly, at this point in time, if you could just review for me the particular sections of the plan that you are principally relying on, that would be very helpful.
Okay. Number one, I adamantly, and I think it's crystal clear according to the ERISA claims regulations, that the burden is not on the claimant to say what sections of the plan they're entitled to. And I just was frustrated when the district court made that determination. First of all, the ERISA claims regulation starts out by saying a claim is simply any, I quoted it, a claim for benefits is a request for a plan benefit made by the claimant.
So in your view, and actually I'm sure this is often true if somebody doesn't have a lawyer, somebody can just go to a plan and say, I'm fill in the blank, you know, retiring, disabled, terminating, whatever. I believe I'm entitled to benefits, and then the plan has to go figure out itself whether there's some section of the plan that would so entitle
them. That's true, and that's why there's two phases to the claims procedure. The first is that initial determination, which the plan has to make. And secondly, is an appeal review procedure. Now, in that initial determination, ERISA claims procedure says, and a plan says, their own plan says, they have to make that determination based on all the governing plan documents. The plan has to do that. And the plan has to establish a reasonable claims procedure and to tell the claimant what sections of the plan he's entitled to a benefit under. And if he's not, if he hasn't submitted everything he was supposed to submit, the ERISA claims procedure says specifically, you have to tell the claimant, here's the information you have to give us that you didn't give us, it's missing or we need more, and here's why we need it. So how anybody could interpret a claimant, particularly an unrepresented claimant, would be able to come in and say, all right, here's I'm claiming this benefit under this section of the plan, and I have to identify each section of the plan in which I'm entitled to the benefit for. I can't see how that was not envisioned by Congress when they passed this law. And I can't see how anybody would interpret it that way.
But once they've turned you down and you're taking an appeal within the administrative structure, isn't it your responsibility to say you got it wrong, you know, here's, you know, section 8.11 or here's whatever section, you know?
Perhaps, Judge.
I mean, surely you're an ERISA lawyer. I'm sure you know much more about ERISA than the average person.
Perhaps that would be, in some cases, that might be true if the plan came back and did what they're supposed to do and say, hey, you didn't tell us the right information or you didn't give us the right information, and here's why we need it. And then it would give the claimant an opportunity to look for it. Now, in this case, you have to understand the claimants didn't even have a copy of the plan when they made their claim. There's no requirement that the claimants get the plan. Just
did the SPD, I assume.
They got the SPD, and that's what they were relying on. And the SPD is supposed to be accurate, and it's filed with the Department of Labor, and they're entitled to rely on it. And that says, in Article 5, Section 6, they are entitled to an early distribution before it would normally be given at death, disability, or retirement. So they said, in January of 1999, we want our distribution in a rollover. Now, also, besides that SPD, the plan sends out terminated participants an annual notice. And in that notice, it tells them right at the bottom, you are entitled to an early distribution, if you so elect, before you would normally be able to get it at death, disability, or retirement. So when they got their notice of terminated participants, it says now you're entitled to it. They let it set in there for the first year. But the second year, they said, now we want it. We have an IRA. We have another employer who has a pension program. We want to roll over our money into that plan. And believe me, this is part of their money, too. Part of it was salary contributions. This is not something the employer gives them. And even if it was, they don't give it to them anyhow. It's compensation for work. So there's no obligation in this case for the plaintiffs to have done anything. And in fact, Judge, the plan administrator violated the first initial determination. They never gave them an initial determination. So there was nothing that they had to respond to. They were never told that they had to identify a particular section of the plan entitling them to a distribution.
Yeah, I'm just looking. I think you're referring to Part 5 of the SPD, Paragraph 6, which says, if you so elect, the administrator will direct the trustee to distribute your vested benefit to you before the date it would normally be distributed upon your death, disability, or retirement. That's your language. Okay.
And that is in direct conflict with Section 7.4A of the plan that says you don't get your money until you die or become disabled or are entitled to retirement. So in these cases...
And could you, before you, I know you're in your rebuttal time, but if you could just sort of tick off the sections of the plan that you think we need to look at.
Well, Section 7.4 is the plan section about distribution. Section 8.11 is the rollover provision. And the rollover provision says you can get a rollover of any distribution, and it defines what a distribution is. And that is why we cited 8.11, because we were asking for a rollover of our distribution.
Okay.
And I think it most importantly, though, are the SPD section, Article 5, Section 6, and the annual notice to the participants that both say the same thing, that they can get an early distribution before death, disability, retirement. Now, when you tell the plaintiffs that and they make that election, they're entitled to rely on it, and they're entitled to that right. Now, one last thing I'd like to say.
This other thing does go on to say if your vested benefit exceeds $50,000, payment of your account balance may be postponed until the first day of the sixth plan year following your separation from service, and the payments may be extended over a five-year period.
That's true, and I'm not denying that. But the determination of the amount of the benefits and the request for the distribution would fix everything at that time. When they paid the money out is a different issue. Okay. That isn't an issue in this case.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear now from Mr. Thomas.
Good morning. May it please the court, Craig Thomas, Reno Zom, on behalf of the appellee. Before I get started, I'd just like to correct a few issues that were raised in Judge Wood's questions. And this gets at the very heart of the administrative and judicial system that's set up. Factual matters are presented at the administrative level. Legal arguments are to be presented to the district court, not factual and legal matters presented for the first time before this court. And one of the reasons is I think counsel said they didn't even have a copy of the plan. His client used to be a trustee of the plan when he worked there. So it's extremely disingenuous to come before this court and say he didn't have a copy of the plan. These parties have been before this court on this same plan before. They've sued on this plan. They've had discovery, boxes of discovery. They've had copies of this plan ad infinitum. And so it becomes difficult to come here before this court and try to respond to arguments and factual matters which were not presented at the administrative level, nor were they raised at the district court level. As I indicated, this case involves the review of the denial of claims under an employee stock ownership plan. This court has determined that the administrator had the requisite discretion and that decisions by this administrator are to be reviewed on an arbitrary and capricious standard. Most significantly, this court should only review those claims that were presented for administrative review, only consider those arguments presented to the district court, and only the evidence that was submitted to the administrator for review during the administrative process. Appellant's attempts to thwart this judicial and administrative process by adding new claims and arguments as they proceed along here. This is aggravated by the fact that these same parties before this same court did this last time, and this court refused to hear them, and this court should refuse to hear them at this point in time. Now, one of the issues, Judge Wood, that you were inquiring about was the vesting of the benefit. And again, this is not fleshed out because this is not part of the argument that's being made. And Mr. Attorney Havrilesko argues now that this isn't about the distribution. It's about the vesting of the benefit. That's not what was requested. What was requested in the appeal hearings were a rollover and then an interpretation of the timing of this ability to begin his diversification.
But I guess I would, what I thought, after all was said and done, this was about, and you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, I thought the reason they wanted the rollover is because you wouldn't be rolling over Reg Ellen stock. You'd be rolling over some amount of money that those shares equaled on the day of the rollover. So in a sense, it struck me as another way of getting at this diversification argument. You know, stock was slipping in value. I mean, we can see that. So obviously, they want the earlier number. And but if they are entitled under the plan to a rollover, then that's the argument they're making, that there was maybe they cited the wrong provision before. I don't know.
It is, I think, the argument they're making. The argument they made before the administrative appeals process was that Section 8.11 entitles them to roll over. That provision is consistent with specific federal statutory authority and regulations, and replete throughout that section are references to eligible distributions. It's a two-part component. You have to be entitled to a distribution. And then what this provision is designed to do under federal law is say the recipient of that distribution doesn't have to take cash and pay taxes on it, because all these plans are subject to ordinary income tax when you take a distribution. You need to give that person the ability to roll it over to an IRA or to roll it over to a new qualified plan if they've got a new employer that accepts them.
With the same tax.
With the same, so that they can defer the tax until they're ultimately going to be using that money. That's the purpose. That's the purpose of that provision. That's the purpose of the statutory authority that from which that provision flows. It in no way, shape, or form is an independent provision that allows someone to take a diversification. Now, if I could just step back on this amount. Again, the provision of the plan that deals with your vested benefit is consistent with federal law, and that doesn't have to do with freezing an account balance. What it has to do with is you are allowed under federal law to reduce if somebody leaves early. There's a vesting period. You can say if you only work at the company for 2 or 3 years,
right,
even though you ordinarily had $10,000 in your account, you're going to get $6,000 because there's a 40% reduction. It doesn't mean that that amount gets frozen in time and is not subject to increases and decreases in whatever the underlying investment is in the plan. And these individuals had some in stock and some in mutual funds and things of that nature. And by no means are they making the argument that their mutual funds should have been frozen for a period of well over 6 years and never been distributed. The plan doesn't call for that, and frankly, this is not an issue that was raised at the administrative level or at the district court level. And Judge Wood, you touched on the fact that doesn't the plan say you can defer it if the account balance was over $50,000 and spread it? That's exactly what happened. I think Mr. Havrilesko indicated, and just to clarify, the last
payment. That was in the SPD, right?
Yes. The last payment has been gets actually written out to them in the next month or so, and then they're no longer the plan. That's in the SPD, and it's in the it's in the plan document itself. But what's important to note here is the ever-shifting nature of the evidence and the claims that were presented. And cut it right down to its core, there's 4 counts in the complaint before the district court. Counts 1 and 3 are identical, just James Hess versus John Hess, and same with 2 and 3. 1 and 3 are the rollover claims. They're the claims that say Section 8.11. There's no dispute. We do not argue that they didn't exhaust their administrative
remedies.
Right, so
remedies. We're clear. 1 and 3 are exhausted, and it's your point it's just 2 and 4 that are
and
not.
5 is exhausted as well. 5
okay,
was
five
the timing, whether it should have been 1 year earlier on. How does the phrase within 90 days qualify? Does it qualify the plan year that you make
right,
the election
age,
or the age?
Right.
It's 2 and 4, and there can be no doubt that these liquidation and segregation claims were not submitted to the administrative level. And
but how much burden is there? I mean, I guess I've worried a little bit about what is it that the plan really has to do. Once somebody says, I want some money, at what level of detail does the person have to say, you know, and here are all the reasons, you know, I've combed through this 100-page plan and, you know, this long SPD. Do they have to cite chapter, book, and verse to the plan?
No, they don't. And although it's a long plan and there's a summary plan description, if somebody's looking for a distribution, there's an article in the plan that says distribution of benefits. And in there it lays out the circumstances under which one might be entitled to a distribution of benefits. If it's the surviving spouse of a deceased participant, death triggers it. If there's disability, termination depending upon certain circumstances, how big your account balance was. So while it's not incumbent upon the participant to cite chapter and verse of their claim, it is simply more than saying, here's the plan, give me every benefit I'm entitled to. And at a minimum, once the plan comes back and says you're not entitled to a distribution now because the plan says you're a terminated employee and here's the timing and here's everything, for them to come back and say, I disagree. I either see another provision in the plan that I think entitles me that contradicts that, or there's something in a summary plan description or something else. It's not good enough to simply say, give me all the benefits, and then when you don't raise the argument at the district court level, wait until the federal appellate court level and start arguing regulations that really aren't related to what the inquiries were here. And that gets back to the issue. A lot of what's argued in this brief deals with the 29 U.S.C. 1133 argument regarding the full and fair hearing at the administrative level. That has never been raised. This has always been a 29 U.S.C. 1132, which is a claim for benefits provision, and that's how it was responded. And if the issue had been raised there, the administrator would have looked at that. But again, it's disingenuous for these appellants to come before this court and in any way, shape, or form argue that they have not had a full and fair opportunity. They have been engaged in litigation with this company for years. They've been before this court on claims involving this ESOP. They have adequate and knowledgeable counsel regarding this. And so for them to say that things aren't full and fair, you can see to the extent it is in the record, it's replete with references where their requests were accommodated regarding the timing of the hearing, who would participate in the hearing. They actually wanted the whole board of directors of the company, the whole board of directors.
They all went, right?
Yeah, we'll do that. This is a small company. This is a company with less than 100 employees, and the burden that's been placed on the company is enormous. And so, in a long-winded way, to your answer to say, is there a burden on the other side or on the participant to cite chapter and verse? No, there's not. But it can't be an unlimited burden on the company, the administrator of this plan, to simply spend hours and scores of legal time on any possible benefit a participant could have that they haven't come without the participant making you aware, making the company, the administrator aware of that benefit. If there's no further questions, I'll return the balance of my time to the court.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas.
Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Havrilesko have? You have 1 minute, sir.
Your Honors, I think it's important to note here that the focus on an ERISA claim should be on whether the claimant is entitled to the benefit, not whether the plan administrator can hide behind provisions of the plan or the nearly impenetrable shield of the deference discretionary standard of review that the courts apply. I raised every issue in the hearing that is went before the district court and is before this court. I raised the amount of what the amount of the rollover should be in the administrative hearing. In fact, Mr. Thomas asked me particularly, what amount are you asking for? And I told him what the amount we were asking for, the amount of their vested benefits in the year 1998 that they reported to the IRS was the vested amount of their benefits. Now, that was raised in the administrative hearing. It was also raised in the district court. District court just simply ignored it, and Mr. Thomas apparently simply ignored it. They also simply ignored my 4204 letter explaining to them what all the provisions of the plan we were looking for. And that was never considered at all by the district court, although they said it was untimely. Thank you.
Our thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.